It was a lot of fun. I have to say, I didn't say it last week. I have to, though. My daughter created that bumper video, so it's a lot of fun to have her do that. And actually, she snuck herself into it. So if you're here next week, see if you can find where she snuck herself in there. If you're new here, my name's Clay. I get to be one of the pastors here. It is an absolute joy to be in the space, and we're glad that you're here. We are in part two of a series that we are calling This Is Living. And the reason that we're doing this series is because we believe, and I believe certainly, that life should be lived to the full, that life should be enjoyed, that the reason that you have life is to enjoy life. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have hard times. That doesn't mean that, you know, trouble isn't going to come your way. But I believe that even in the midst of the hard times, that you should be able to live your life and have an amazing life. Now, it's not just because it's something that I believe. I believe that because of what Jesus said in John 10:10. It's my favorite verse in all of the Bible, where he says, "I have come that they," and I love replacing "they" with my own name. You can put your name in there. "I have come that Clay," put your name in there, "may have life, a rich and satisfying life." So Jesus says, look, the reason that I came was so that you could enjoy the life that you have. It's not meant to be endured. It's not meant to be just survived. And again, I get that we're all going to have trouble. We've all had things that were bad things that have happened to us, things that we wish would have never happened to us. We're in places that we never thought that we dreamed that we could be. But that does not take away from the idea that even in the midst of that, especially when you're a follower of Jesus and you're in a community like this and you're supported with people like this, that even in the tough times, you can't find the joy that is in life. I just absolutely love life. I love being a dad most of the time. I love my wife. I love what I do for work. I love life, and I want you guys to find that kind of life. And so that's why we're doing this series. And last week, when we started this series, we started with this idea of who you are. And the reason that we did that is because when you read through the Gospels, which are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we read the stories of Jesus, before he would send his disciples out, he would remind them of who they are. Like, I want you to know and I want you to grasp who it is that you are before you go do anything. And so before we asked you to do some things, we're going to give you some thoughts, some ideas that we want you to kind of sit with and plant into your brain. We want you to understand who you are. And last week we said that no matter what society tells you, no matter what your parents have told you, no matter what your friends have told you, no matter what your past and your mistakes and your failures and all these things have told you, the truth of the matter is you are a child of God. That once you come in and you are a follower of Jesus, you are adored by your Creator, that He loves you with everything that He has, and that He is fighting for you, He is on your side, you are adopted in, you are a child of God. And a lot of times in life, everything is going to work against that to try to tell you that you're something less than that. But primarily, everything, all of our other identity comes out of this idea that we are a child of God. And when we wrapped up last week, we said that we would give you three life principles, three keystones, three things to live by. Now, this isn't like three steps to a happy living. I don't think, you know, that exists. There's no steps to that. But I'm going to give you three principles that you can begin to live by and apply in your life. And if you will apply these things into your life, you will be further down the road to this rich and satisfying life that Jesus promised us. And so the three things that we're going to talk about one today and then two more of the following 2 weeks, are simply this. Number one, that I believe my story matters. And then next week, we're going to talk about I'm fully present in this life. Okay, I'm not living in the past. I'm not living in the future. And then this idea that I'm unashamed of how God made me. Again, these are principles that you can learn, things that you can apply to your life, and you can refute all the lies that show up in your head and all the lies that you've been told, and you can really start living. So this week, we're going to look at this one right here. I believe my story matters. I believe my story matters. Now, I get that some of us, maybe there's a lot of us inside of this room, when you see a statement like this on the screen, your first thought is, I'm not sure that I believe that. Like, that may be true of other people that are in this room, but I'm not sure that I believe that my story matters. Like, Clay, you don't understand what I've been through. You don't understand all the things that have happened in my life. But I'm here to tell you, no matter what has happened, no matter what has transpired, no matter what you have gone through, I believe and I know that your story matters. And it doesn't matter if you're here and you are a follower of Jesus or you're not a follower of Jesus. I want you to understand that your Father loves you. And He says that your story matters. Now, He wants to invite you into the life with Jesus because that's where you can really, truly begin to live. But no matter what is going on in your background, your life matters. And when it comes to our life, the reason that we don't believe this is because of we have history. We have things that have been done to us. There are things that we have done. We have fallen down. There's embarrassing things. There's things that are shameful. There's things that we wish no one ever knew about that are in our past. There are mistakes that have been made. There's good. There's bad. There's broken dreams. There's things that have been dashed. And all of that begins to tell us that our story doesn't matter. Now, when we use the word story around here at Next Level, it has a meaning. We use it all the time. We say your story is safe here. What we mean by that is your life. Your life story, what you have lived, because all of your life is a story. And it's why your heart is drawn to stories, because that is what your life is. Your life is a story. And when you think of story, we put this in your notes. It'd be kind of fun to think about it in these terms. Which of these best describes your life? When you think about a story, right? Because there's different categories, and there's different genres of stories that are out there. Right, and maybe you're going through your life right now, and your story feels like a comedy, right? It's just everything just seems to be happening to you. Maybe you feel like you're living out Dumb and Dumber right now, right? And everything that happens in your life, you're like, I just can't believe that this kind of thing would happen. But you feel like you're just the butt of everybody's jokes. That when you see people, you feel like they're laughing about you over in the corner, maybe because you dress a little bit differently. Maybe you act a little bit differently. Maybe you think a little bit differently. Maybe you have some sort of impairment, and people like to point out all of those differences, and people highlight those things. And so you're kind of used to being pushed down, and you're kind of at a place where you're just kind of used to people making fun of you and laughing about you. And so maybe you just think that your life is a comedy where everybody's laughing at you, but you're not laughing. Or maybe your idea is that you are action and adventure, or at least you want to be action and adventure. Like, yeah, that's the story that I want to tell. I remember when I was younger, I'm going to date myself a little bit, and I went to the movies, and I saw for the first time Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark. How many old people we got here? All right. I wanted to be Indiana Jones, man. Like, I wanted to run from the rock. I wanted to find the lost ark, right? Or how about the movie, it's my favorite movie of all times, Braveheart. Like, yeah, I want that. I want to stand up for what is right, and I want to do all these right things. I just don't want my story to end like Braveheart's story ends. Like, everything else is good. Let's just stop there, right? Or how about Gladiator? Any Gladiator fans, right? Where you want to live this life of adventure. You want to be able to have a moment where you say a line, like he says. Like, there's that moment where a gladiator is in the ring and he's fighting the gladiator, and the emperor comes down, the evil Commodus comes down, and he takes and he wants the gladiator to remove his mask. Remember that moment? And he has that great line, and he says, "What is your name?" And he says, "My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, Commander of the armies of the north, general of the Felix Legion, true servant to the true king, Marcus Aurelius." Yeah, true servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will take my revenge in this life or the next, right? You just want to live to say that in one moment. You know, and when we were younger, that's the vision that we had for our life, that we're going to have these great moments and these great times. And then real life happens. Like, real life happens. And I wind up, I'm not Maximus, I'm taking out the trash. Right? I just don't think that Braveheart went grocery shopping. Right? In Indiana Jones, you never see him washing the dog, mowing the grass. Right? And so maybe you feel like your life should be an action adventure, but it's not. Or maybe you feel like your life is a romance. Or maybe it's a tragic romance, I'm not sure. You want your life to be like Ever After, but it's not Ever After. You know, you're kind of perpetually trapped in some sort of dramatic turns of endearment movie where everything just goes wrong. Right? It's just, you want romance, but it's not there. Maybe you keep trying to find the one, and you think you find the one, and then the one leaves, and then you find another one, and then they leave. And so you find another one, right? And eventually you find yourself, and maybe you've been married two or three times, and you're dating again, and you don't want to tell the person that you're dating that you've been married two or three times because you're afraid that they're going to leave. And again, there's no judgment here. I understand. I understand how you might feel. And so you think, well, I want to have a romance, but I just don't know if that's even possible for me. Or maybe your life is just a tragedy. You know, it's some sort of dramatic tragedy. It's some sort of reenactment of Fried Green Tomatoes. You ever seen Fried Green Tomatoes? The beginning of Fried Green Tomatoes, Buddy gets hit by a train. It's just one tragedy after another, after another, after another. Then the movie ends and you're depressed. And you say, well, that's my life. Or maybe your life, you say, is just a horror movie. Like it's just bad things have happened to me, and it's just a matter of not, it's just when another bad thing is going to happen, and maybe your parents did some horrible things, or a teacher had done some horrible things, or someone that was close to you had done some terribly horrific things, honestly. And so your life, you would just say, yeah, it's just been one big horror movie. But no matter what you identify with, as you begin to think about your life, it is easy to begin to think that your story and your life doesn't matter. And the reason you think that is because if my life mattered, then people wouldn't treat me the way they treat me. If my life mattered, really mattered, if my story mattered, then people would not talk about me the way that they talk about me. If my life mattered, then people wouldn't be laughing at me right now. If my life mattered, I would be out living a life of excitement and adventure. But instead, I'm stuck in this cycle of good and bad, where there's a whole lot of bad and not enough good. And if my story mattered, then there would be just more good things that are happening in my life. If my life mattered, then my spouse and I, we wouldn't end up in as many fights as we end up in. And we'd be more of a perfect marriage, kind of like our neighbors are across the street. They just seem like they're such a perfect couple. And so we start comparing ourselves to other people. And we compare our lives to other people's lives. And we do it a lot on social media. And again, I tell people all the time, you're comparing your real life with their highlight reel. And when you compare, you begin to think, well, they matter and I don't matter because they're living such a perfect life. Let me tell you, anyone who claims to be living a perfect life and says that they're perfect, I can tell you one thing about them. They're a liar. No one's perfect. That's why we can say as a church, no perfect people allowed. People are like, oh, you don't allow perfect people. No, because there's no perfect people. And if you think you're perfect and you come here, we'd rather you not stay because you'll mess the place up. So, like, nobody is perfect. Even people that we think have it all together. We think celebrities and people who have fame and fortune and they have their lives together. And then we find out that they don't. It's because we're all imperfect people. And because we feel like our life isn't perfect, and it's got bumps, it's got bruises, it's got things in the past that I wish no one, we choose to keep our life a secret. I don't want to tell anybody about the things that are going on in my life. I'm not sure that would make a difference anyway. And so we choose to keep our story inside, and we choose to keep it close at heart. And I love this quote by Maya Angelou, who says this, "There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of you." And what she's saying, and I think it is true, is that when we continue to say, I'm not going to tell my story, there's just something inside of you that agonizes over that. Because every time you feel like you can't share your story, you're reinforcing the lie that says your life doesn't matter. Because the truth is, your story really does matter. And some of you right now, you're like, I don't know. You know, as my story has untold, you have told yourself over and over and over, if people just knew what I had been through, I'm pretty sure they would write me off. If people just knew what I had experienced, if people knew what had been done to me, if people knew what I have done, I'm sure they would write me off. If they knew my nickname, if they knew I really didn't get into the college that I wanted to, if they knew I've been lying about my salary and I really don't make what I tell people that I make, if people knew, if people knew, if people knew. And you think that if people knew your real story that they would reject you and they would turn you away and people would push you back because you don't matter. And so you think my story doesn't matter. But you see, I don't believe that. Not for one minute. It doesn't matter to me how awful your story is. It doesn't matter to me how tragic everything is in your background and in your past. It doesn't matter to me the things that you're ashamed of, you're embarrassed of. All of those things, I believe God uses all of those things. But you have to be willing to let it out. And today, what I want to do is I want to help you begin to believe, maybe believe again, maybe believe for the first time, that your story really does matter. Because I believe God uses imperfect stories all the time. He uses my story, and my story is far from perfect. He uses stories that are filled with holes, with gaps, with disasters, with mistakes, with wrongs, with things that we try to cover up, with things that we kind of stretch the truth with on social media. God uses all of those stories all of the time to accomplish great things, to really, truly help people, and I want to show you that today. And so to go where we want to go today, we're going to go into the Old Testament in the Bible to a particular book called Esther. And if you've got the YouVersion Bible app, you can pull that up. You can read along with us. I'm going to put all the verses on the screen here. But the story of Esther, if you are new to church or coming back to church and you're like, look, I don't know about this God thing. I don't know about this Jesus thing. I don't know if I want to be able to hear all this. Then the book of Esther is a great book for you to read, because here's the interesting thing about Esther. Esther is the only book in the Bible where God's name is not mentioned. It's never mentioned. Although his thumbprints, his feelings, everything about him is all over. You can just feel God all over this book. But in it, he's never mentioned. So let me set the scene for you and give you a little bit of a history lesson, because it'll set what I want to talk to you about. It will ground it a little bit in time. So here's the timeline of Esther. So you have the nation of Israel has been doing things and going their own way. And many times this would happen where Israel would get away from God, and when they would get away from God, God would bring judgment. So one of the judgments he brings on Israel is Babylon comes into Israel, and they conquer Jerusalem. And they take everyone out of the country, and they take them back to Babylon. And then this king, Belshazzar, destroys the temple in Jerusalem. So there is nothing to go back to. Right, until Nehemiah rebuilds the temple some years later, the temple is destroyed, and all of Israel is stuck now in Babylon wondering what is going on, what is going on, what is our life like? Well, God brings judgment on Babylon through a guy named Darius. And Darius comes in, and he is the leader of the Persians. The Persians come in, and they conquer the Babylonians, and they take all of their captives, all of their prisoners, and now they become a part of the Persian Empire, and this is all done under Darius. And so Darius reigns for a number of years. If you have read the Bible, or even if you haven't, you've heard of the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Everybody heard that story? That's this king, and that's this time period that's going on right here. After Darius, Darius dies, and his son, Xerxes, takes over. So when Xerxes takes over the kingdom, first thing he does is put down a revolt in Egypt, and he makes sure that Egypt stays under their control. The interesting thing about Xerxes, not only is he the king of the Persian Empire, he is the pharaoh of Egypt, which is interesting. So he does that, and then he goes on a campaign to destroy Athens and go into Greece. If you've ever seen the movie 300, anyone ever seen the movie 300? That's the story. This is the king. The movie 300 depicts the time when Xerxes comes in, it's a true story, into the Battle of Thermopylae, where he faces 300 Spartan soldiers who hold him off for days. I can't remember if it's days or weeks, until they're betrayed by someone. Xerxes actually defeats them, makes his way all the way to Athens, and burns down the great city of Athens. So the reason this is important is the story of Esther takes place after this, at the height of his reign. There is no one in the world that can stand up to Xerxes. He is king of everything. And because of that, anything that Xerxes wants, Xerxes gets. So if he wants a food item, he gets it. If he wants land, he gets it. If he wants a building built, they build it. If he wants to take someone as a slave, they become a slave. If he wants to take someone as a concubine or a wife, then he takes them. You have no say. Whatever the king wants, the king gets. And Xerxes is a bit of a self-centered person, as most kings in those days were. So Xerxes is very powerful. There's a couple of characters that begin to show up in Esther. So we have King Xerxes, who, again, has whatever he wants to be able to have in his life, and he has several different queens. He also has a harem with a lot of concubines in it that was always nearby, and anytime he would want one, he would send for them, and they would come to him. Well, one of his favorite queens that he had is Queen Vashti. Now, obviously, this is not really Queen Vashti. I just thought, well, that's a good picture of her. Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti was a beautiful king, queen, and she was Xerxes' favorite. And he loved her a lot. Well, in the book of Esther, Xerxes is throwing a party. And at his party, it went on for days. He had all the dignitaries from all of his kingdom all around. And they'd gotten pretty smashed at this point. And in his drunken state, he calls for Queen Vashti to come and present herself. Now, when you begin to read and dig a little bit further into the actual language, it wasn't that he just needed her to show up and say, hey, I'm Queen Vashti. Present herself. We got kids in the room. It was a little deeper meaning of what he was asking from her. And what I love about this girl is she tells the king, no. I doubt Xerxes has ever heard that two-letter word ever in his life. He's never heard no. No one tells the king no. But she says, no, I'm not going to do it. Message gets back to Xerxes. He is infuriated. Like, you can't tell me no. And so he sends another request. Hey, I'm not asking. I am telling you to come. And she says, no. I love, there are some women characters in the Bible. I'm telling you, if you think there's no good examples of women in the Bible, there are some great examples. And this is one. She stood her ground. Well, in his sense of drunkenness and in his anger, he makes what he calls an irrevocable decree that she must be banished from the kingdom. And so he does. And so Vashti is now gone. The next day or a couple of days later, he sobers up and he begins to miss Vashti. But he made an irrevocable decree to banish her. And so he can't do anything about it. To which you're reading the story, you're like, dude, you're the king. Like, no one sits above you. Just make an irrevocable decree that revokes the irrevocable decree and bring her back. But he doesn't. And so he goes on the look for a queen to replace this woman that he loved and he cared very deeply about. And that's when he encounters a beautiful Jewish woman named Esther. And when he sees Esther for the first time, his mind is blown. And he's like, wow, this is a beautiful, beautiful woman. Now, Esther was raised by her cousin. Her cousin was older, and his name is Mordecai. So Mordecai raises Esther. And the reason that Esther is living with Mordecai is because her parents had passed away under the captivity of the Babylonians. And so he took her in and raised her as his own. So as far as the story goes, yes, it's a cousin, but it is more like the dad and the daughter. The dad and the daughter. And so when Mordecai hears that King Xerxes would like to see her, he calls Esther in and says, I need to tell you something. You're about to be in front of the king, and you're a beautiful woman, and he's going to want to take you as his queen. You cannot tell him or anyone in the palace that you're Jewish. You can't let anybody know what your background is. You can't let anyone know where your family is from. You need to keep this a secret because there's already some anti-Semitism developing inside the empire. And so he gives her this. You can't talk about your past. Your past needs to stay in your past, and no one needs to hear your story. That's one part of your story that you cannot tell. So, Mordecai, Esther comes into the kingdom, and again, Xerxes is just taken with her. You read through the story, and he's like asking the palace guards, so what did she say? Where's Esther at? Like, he's writing boxes, do you love me? Check yes or no, and sending them, right? And so eventually, he takes her as the queen, and she becomes a queen and comes into his family as one of many queens, but a favored queen that's there. Now, we enter into the fourth character of the story, which becomes important, and we get Haman. Right. I just think that one's good, because I think Alan Rickman, he just plays such a bad guy, doesn't he? So now we have Haman. And ironically, Haman is a snake in the story. I mean, he really is, right, for you Harry Potter fans. Anyway, Haman is King Xerxes' right-hand man. He's kind of the head of state. Whatever the king says, he does, and this is his go-to person. So because of his position, anywhere that Haman would go out into the empire, into the streets, into the cities, everyone would have to bow down to Haman. So one day, he is out, he's walking past the street, and everybody is bowing down to him except for Mordecai. Mordecai's not going to do it. Again, God's name is not mentioned, but the reason that Mordecai says he's not going to do it is out of his reverence for God. Like, I will only bow down to God, and I'm not going to bow down to you. And so Haman stops him and says, no, you are going to bow down. And he very directly says, no, I'm not going to. So this enrages Haman. He becomes so angry that he makes a decision. Not only is he going to kill Mordecai, but he is so mad and so angry, he's going to wipe out the entire Jewish race. He's going to commit genocide because of this one man. Now, if you got anger issues, dude. If you go from, I want to take you out, to take you and all your people out, actually, you're just insane. And so this is what he does, and he comes to King Xerxes, and he kind of tricks King Xerxes into doing something. At least he doesn't fully reveal what it is that he's wanting to do. And Xerxes signs a decree that makes it legal to wipe out and kill all of the Jewish people. So panic begins to set in the streets. Everybody, you can imagine, if you're Jewish, like, dude, it is now going to be, if it isn't already, soon it's going to be perfectly legal for people to kill us in the street. That this is going to be the end. Now, while all this is going on, Esther is completely unaware because she is in the palace. She doesn't know what is happening. So Mordecai writes a letter and sends it and delivers it to Esther that basically says, here is what is going on. You need to leverage your authority. You need to leverage your place with the king. You need to leverage your story to see if you can prevent this and stop this. And this is where we'll begin with our part of the story in Esther chapter 4. This is Esther's reply back to Mordecai after he makes this request. All the king's officials and even the people in the provinces know that anyone who appeared before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. Now, let me explain this. What she is saying is, Mordecai, you don't know, you can't walk into the throne room of the king. Because if you walk into the throne room of the king and he doesn't extend his scepter, if he doesn't say, it's okay, you die. And you just don't want to walk into throne rooms of kings. How many movies have you seen about kings? When are they ever in a good mood? Kings are always in a bad mood. They're always fighting wars. They're always putting down rebellions. They're always raising taxes. They're always trying to get to someone who's trying to kill them in their own family. It's like, I know they're trying to assassinate me. They're just always in a bad mood. You don't want to go interrupt the king. You want to make an appointment. You don't want to show up unannounced. You don't understand, Cousin Mordecai, if I do this, I am about 90% certain that I'm going to die. This is just the way it's going to happen. I'm going to walk in, and I'm going to die because he hasn't called for me in 30 days. What she's saying is the king has already forgotten about me. He's called for other women. He hasn't called for me. I'm yesterday's news. If I go walking in there, I'm just old news, and I'm going to be killed. And here's Mordecai's reply back to all of that. Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace that you will escape when all other Jews are killed. Like, you're not, just because you're in the palace, don't think you're going to get out of this. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place. Hey, God's going to bring deliverance. But in the meantime, he says, but you and your relatives, aka me, Mordecai, will die. Hey, Esther, I know you think that you could die if you walk into the throne room. I'm here to tell you, you're going to die either way. Either you're going to walk in there, or you're going to not walk in there, and when they find out you're a Jew and this decree goes out, you're going to die. The only chance you have to not die is to walk in and share your story. That thing that I told you that you shouldn't talk to anyone about. Can you imagine the pressure that Esther is under? She's been told this whole part of her adult life, don't share your story. Don't share your story. Don't share your story. And now she's at a crossroads. Do I share my story? Because if I do, I could die. And if I do, I could help. This is a tremendous amount of pressure. And then Mordecai has this line, even if you're not a church person, you've probably heard some version of this line. It's one of the best lines in the Old Testament, I think. He says, who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this. Who knows, Esther? Maybe your story and everything you have was for just this moment. Esther goes in. The king welcomes her. She shares her story. She talks about the plot. Haman is dealt with. Mordecai, he gets honored. And the Jewish people are saved. You have to know that in Esther's head, though, leading into this, she has to be scared to death and thinking, who am I? What if people really know who I am? What if people really know where I am from? What if people really know the background of my story? Have you ever been there? Have you ever thought that? Have you ever felt that? Maybe you look back on your story and you see the mistakes you've made, the wrongs that have happened to you, the wrongs that you have forced onto other people, maybe the way that you've been treated, the way that you treated other people, and you think, what if people knew? And all of a sudden, you find yourself at a crossroads. Do I share my story or do I not share my story? And I think in our lives, we encounter a crossroads like that, not just once, but many times. And most of us, we're just not aware enough of our relationship with God or what God is trying to do to step into that. That thing that says, here I am scared to death, but do I choose to go down the path that potentially could help people? Do I choose to share my story? Because my story is imperfect. I got news for you. Everybody's story is imperfect. No one has a perfect story. Your story is filled with gaps. It's filled with dreams and disasters. It's filled with good, bad, perfect, imperfect. But what you have is a beautifully imperfect story. And here's the thing I want you to know. Your imperfect story matters to imperfect people. All the things that you think is wrong with your life, all the things that you think are bad, they matter to people who also have an imperfect story. All the good, all the bad, all you have to do is own it. Yep, I've got an imperfect story. The moment that you own you have an imperfect story, you have the opportunity to share and to help and to get into the lives of other imperfect people. And I get that we have all done wrong. Yes, I get that we've had wrong done to us and we're a victim. But we have a crossroad in front of us where we can either live in our past or we can walk into our future with our Father who says, look, I can use your imperfect story. Because your imperfect story matters to imperfect people. You see, you would not be who you are if it were not for all the imperfections. You would not be you without the good and the bad. You would not be you without the perfect and the imperfect. You would not be you without the dreams and the disasters. It's what makes you who you are. And sometimes what happens is our past can make us feel like that we're a nobody. Esther easily could have said, "Who am I? I'm just some Jewish girl. I got no way over the king." And you may be thinking, there's nothing that I can do. You know, I am just an imperfect person. I'm a nobody. I don't matter. Here's a great verse if you feel like you're a nobody. This is the Message paraphrase, says this. This is God talking. He says, "I'll call nobodies and make them somebodies. I'll call the unloved and make them beloved. In the place where they yelled out, 'You're nobody,' they're calling God's living children." You see, Jesus didn't die for a nobody. Jesus died to make you a somebody. And everyone in this space is a somebody, and you are not a mistake. Your life is not a mistake. You are not too messy to matter. And I'm not saying that what was done to you was right and in your past. I'm not saying that what you've done in your past was right. But I'm saying that God can use any of those things to do great things. I love this translation in Romans 8. It says, "We know that in everything God works for the good of those who love him." Everything. So it doesn't matter what you've been going on in your life. It doesn't matter all the things that you're afraid of and ashamed of and embarrassed of. God can still do great things with those. And so this is what I want you to just ask yourself this week. Who needs to hear your imperfect story? Who needs to hear it? With all of the bad, with all of the bumps, with all of the bruises that are there. You see, if you're a believer in Jesus, we are called to do more than come and sit in rows and listen to sermons and sing songs and pray and go home. That's consumeristic Christianity. That's not what we've been called to. You are called to help people. That's why you're here. That's why God didn't just take you away the moment you believed in Jesus. You have a job to do. And your job is to help people. So who in your world needs to hear your imperfect story? Who is it that you go to school with or work with? Who in your neighborhood? Maybe it's that person, they're going through a divorce right now, and you've gone through a divorce. And you've never shared that part of your life, but you need to kind of come to them and say, "Hey, I've been where you're at. I can tell you that you can get past this, that there's life on the other side." Or maybe there's someone in your life and they're going through an extended time of job loss. And you've gone through the same thing. You went through losing your job, and you know what it feels like. You know the pressure that it is to be under when people are coming and wanting to you to provide, and you can't. Maybe there's somebody, you just need to come to them. You need to say, "Hey, I've been where you're at. I felt like there was no hope, and then I got a job too. It took a while, but I got a job. You'll get one too. Don't give up." Maybe it's that family that's struggling with infertility, and you went through that same struggle. And maybe God allowed you to have a baby, or maybe God didn't, and you went through and you adopted, and you have a story of this is what it's like, and you need to tell them, "Hey, I've been there. I know the thoughts and the processes you're going through, but this is the end result. This is where I'm at in my life, and I just think you need to hear that." There are people all around us that need to hear your imperfect story. You see, God can use your imperfect story to speak to imperfect people. And I think if we did this, if we asked ourselves, "Who needs to hear my story?" And if we would step out into that, I think our life would be a little brighter. And I think if all of us took on that, I believe our community would be a little brighter. Your imperfect story matters to imperfect people. The best people to minister to broken people are broken people. And that's you. Let me pray for you. So Jesus, here in this space, we ask that you speak to us. Many of us here, we are walking through and We feel like our story, man, there's no way you can use us, God. We don't matter. God, I pray that you would help us see that it does matter, that you make us matter, and how you can use our story. God, I pray that we would commit to sharing it with everyone that's around, and that you would do amazing things with it. Let us step into that. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you, Clay. I'm going to ask you.